Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, this is Backstory with the American History Guys.
Welcome to the show. I'm Brian Bellow.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Peter Onuf. In the summer of 1857, bullets began to fly on the outskirts of San Antonio, Texas. In a series of ambushes, Anglo men on horseback would assault Mexican traders hauling freight on ox carts. Some of the attackers wore masks. Others blackened their faces. They carried guns and sometimes used them, and not just for warning shots.
One man was shot point blank in the chest.
This is Larry Knight, a historian at Texas A&M University in Kingsville. He says the ambushes were not an attempt to steal the cartmen's cargo. This was the opening salvo in a turf war.
Here's the background. The Mexican cartmen had a monopoly on hauling freight in Texas. Anglo Teamsters wanted to be in on the action, and they were willing to shed blood to snuff out the competition. By September 1857, they were murdering cartmen. But since the rural counties where the attacks happened were mostly Anglo, county officials refused to crack down on the attackers.
Nobody's going to go after them, not a justice of the peace, not a sheriff, not a marshal. As far as they're concerned, all of these Mexicans should be killed, run out of the state. So there's no sympathy for the Mexican cartmen who were being killed.
In San Antonio, it was a different story. People there saw the cartmen as an economic lifeline.
They were bringing in clothing. They were bringing in just almost anything that you used on a daily basis of life. It would be brought in by the cartmen. So San Antonio was quite dependent upon this trade for survival.
They began calling the ambushes the Cart War. City politicians visited the attack sites to pressure locals to do something. They wrote outraged letters to the governor of Texas. Even the U.S. Secretary of State got involved.
They finally are able to convince the governor to raise up a militia unit. The militia unit then begins to escort the cart trains, and then the thing just ends seemingly quietly.
But when the time came to pay the bill for the militia, well, not everyone was on board. The Texas legislature convened to debate the issue, and the big question was,
why are we protecting Mexicans with Texas dollars?
Opposition was particularly fierce in Goliad County, the site of several attacks. Goliad also happened to be the place where 20 years earlier the Mexican army had gunned down hundreds of Anglo troops during the Texas fight for independence. For many, it was a harsh irony.
And so the representative from Goliad says, are basically, in modern parlance, are you kidding me? We're going to protect Mexicans who slaughtered Fannin and his men back in 1836? That's unconscionable.
But here's the thing. Most of the people these Anglos called Mexican were actually U.S. citizens. Many of the cartmen had been born in Texas back when it was part of Mexico. And when Texas joined the U.S. in 1848, everyone living there automatically got U.S. citizenship.
Take Antonio Delgado, one of the cartmen who was murdered during the Cart War. He was well known in San Antonio as a veteran of the U.S. Army. He'd even fought under Andrew Jackson.
He stood up for liberty. Stood up for liberty as a Mexican fighting for independence. Stood up with the Americans fighting against the British in the War of 1812. Stood up for Texas in its war for independence against Mexico. What proves you love liberty more than putting your life on the line in three separate wars?
So when people from Goliad resisted using tax dollars to protect Mexicans, state legislators from San Antonio basically said, what are you talking about? These guys are American patriots. And not to mention,
these are United States citizens.
Long story short, the militia was funded and the attacks stopped.
But the spat over who counted as American reflected a broader reality about mid-19th century Texas. There were few clear lines between us and them, between Mexican and American. Farmers who had lived in the same spot for 50 years had been Spanish, then Mexican, then Texan, then American, all without moving an inch. Today, it's easy to think of the border as a straightforward dividing line. But for most of our history, there's been nothing straightforward about it.
So this week on Backstory, we're asking how the flow of people and ideas across the border has shaped the U.S.-Mexican relationship. The two countries have been neighbors, rivals, enemies, and now close trading partners. So how have these two nations defined themselves in relation to each other? How has that relationship changed over time? And what does U.S. history look like when seen from Mexico?
In the spirit of NAFTA, we begin the show today with a trade story. It ends with a major shift in Mexican economic policy, but it starts with an American scientist on a quest.
Here's the setup. In the early 20th century, hormone therapy was the next big thing in U.S. medical research. Hormones were marketed as cure-alls for everything from diabetes to eczema to psychosis.
But hormones were hard to come by, so scientists who wanted to do research had to get creative.
They knew that in male urine you could find minute quantities of testosterone. So they said, where can we find a lot of male urine?
That's Gabriela Soto Laviaga, a historian at UC Santa Barbara.
They set up these huge vats outside of bars where men would urinate, and then they would take these vats to pharmaceutical companies where they extract these very small amounts of hormones.
An American chemist named Russell Marker wanted to find a better way. He knew that plants like yams and yuccas naturally created a molecule similar to another key hormone, progesterone. He figured that if he could find a plant with just the right chemical qualities, he could guarantee a supply of progesterone.
So in the 1930s, Marker set out on a quest to find that perfect plant. He traveled across the U.S., visiting state after state after state, but nothing quite worked. Laviaga says that eventually Marker just lost hope.
And he gives up in Texas, and he's staying at the home of a botanist. And he picks up this random book, and in it is a picture of a giant Mexican yam. So he continues this rather wild goose chase. This is 1941, in the midst of the war, and takes a train down to Mexico City, not speaking Spanish, not knowing where Veracruz, the southeastern Mexican state where this route was found, where that was located, and somehow makes it to the state of Veracruz.
Doesn't sound promising. What happens?
He manages to, very astutely, he goes to the local little five-and-dime shop owner, and he says that he's looking for these gigantic yams that are grown somewhere around there. The shop owner, not speaking English, but tells him that he understands, and for him to come back the next day. And Russell Marker goes back the next day, and sure enough, this shop owner has two samples of these giant yams waiting for him.
Just by the way, how big are these yams?
About 125 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so he takes them back to a makeshift laboratory, and he manages to synthesize more progesterone than had ever been discovered up until that point in humankind's history.
Wow.
So he's in Mexico City, and he flips open the phone book, and he says, I didn't know Spanish, but I knew the word laboratory, and I knew the word hormone. So I was looking for both of those words, and he finds a laboratory called Laboratorios Hormona, which fortunately for Marker was Hormone Laboratory. And he takes his discovery there, and they are astounded.
So what kind of deal did he cut with this laboratory?
The business end of the laboratory, a man named Emerico Somlo and the chemist, whose name was Dr. Lehman, they immediately recognize that there's a lot of profit to be made, and just in terms, not only profit, but just the scientific advancement that can happen with Russell Marker's discovery is immense. So they say, why don't the three of us, Somlo, Lehman, and Marker, begin a company? And we'll call it Syntex. And Syntex is the merging of synthesis and Mexico. And wow. Syntex would eventually become one of the most profitable, if not the most profitable, transnational pharmaceutical company of the Western Hemisphere.
Okay, let's pause here and recap what happens over the next 20 years. In 1951, scientists working for Syntex in Mexico City made an amazing discovery. They created the very first oral contraceptive, the birth control pill. After that, hormones became an even bigger business, all fueled by those amazing Mexican yams.
Over the next few decades, lots of other companies got into the game. Many were based in the U.S. They'd buy Barbasco from Mexican peasants, export it, and synthesize their drugs in American labs. It seemed like a stable setup.
Until, in 1970, a populist named Luis Echeverria was elected president of Mexico. Echeverria had big plans to improve the country's health and education systems. But to put those plans into action, his government needed money, and that took the form of foreign aid. That's where Laviaga picks up the story.
And Mexico at the time turns to the World Bank, and the World Bank says, well, one of the problems that you have in your country is overpopulation. And this is where the Mexican government steps in. And one of the advisors said, well, you know, we should, as a nation, look into developing a Mexican oral contraceptive pill. So the presidential advising team goes and they start to do research. And lo and behold, not only do they have it, but Mexico was the first one to bring it to market.
So let me just try to keep track here.
Sure.
Mexico is being pressured to reduce its population. It says, all right, we'll do a study on population control. And as a result of that, discovers that birth control pills really originate in Mexico from the Barbasco yam.
Yes.
So what does Echeverria do about this?
So he realizes that those who are picking the yams are hundreds of thousands of Mexican peasants. So he realizes the voting potential. And he also realizes the amount of money that could come into the Mexican state's coffers if they could control the steroid hormone industry trade. And he decides to create a company called Prokivimex. And basically, it will be the negotiator between transnational pharmaceutical companies and peasants in order to increase what is being paid to peasants and at the same time be producing patent medications. The problem is that transnational pharmaceutical companies were quite savvy when they established themselves in Mexico. And Echeverria falsely calculated that their hands were tied. And I say falsely calculated because had this happened in the 1950s, when Barbasco was the only known source of steroid hormones, then maybe transnational pharmaceutical companies would have yielded.
Mm-hmm.
But this, by the 1970s, transnational pharmaceutical companies have started to look to other natural raw material, such as soy and henequen, because they know that the political winds are changing in Mexico. And as any savvy business person will do, you don't put all your eggs in one basket. And Echeverria doesn't understand this. He's come late to the Barbasco game.
So explain to me how the Prokivimex story fit into the larger context of Mexico's economy in the 1970s.
So in the 1970s, Echeverria's policies were really devoted for redistributing Mexico's wealth. And to do that, the government thought that it needed to create a series of Mexican companies that covered everything from bicycle production, rubber production, and, of course, Prokivimex. There were over 1,000 of these companies.
Huh.
And the idea was that this was the solution. This was the way that the Mexican government would become independent, would industrialize in a Mexican way. But as you can assume, when you're investing a lot of money, but many of these companies are, like Prokivimex, facing really insurmountable obstacles when it comes to business, they're floundering, and the government is spending more and more money on them. So in 1982, Mexico will have an economic crisis, and in part it is because of this overspending, but also this borrowing to cover all this spending. And this forces the administration to really rethink their economic outlook. And a lot of this is to begin to privatize many of these government-owned companies. It sells off petrochemicals and other raw materials, some basic goods, into private sector companies, whereas before they were part of the public sector.
So that the Prokivimex story was really symbolic of a much larger trend in
Absolutely.
Mexico.
Absolutely.
Do you see this period in the 1980s as a prelude to what eventually will become NAFTA?
Yeah, I think the Mexico's protectionist strategies up until that point had been about protecting raw material, had been about protecting Mexican industry, and there's a real shift that we see in the 1980s. And that we really see that with Proquibemex, an industry that just a mere decade earlier had been touted as this really important industry that was going to develop Mexico and move it into the modern economic world. And 10 years later, it's being dismantled because those economic practices did not work and something new has to be tried.
Gabriela Soto Laviaga is a historian at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She's the author of Jungle Laboratories, Mexican Peasants, National Projects, and the Making of the Pill.
I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Brian Ballo. Today on the show, the long and tangled history of U.S.-Mexican relations.
Our next story focuses on the U.S., Mexico, and a critical third party, the Comanche tribe. In the early 19th century, the Comanches controlled a vast tract of land stretching across what's now the southwestern U.S. At the time, it was recognized Mexican territory.
Initially, the Mexicans and Indians maintained a wary peace. But by the 1830s, Mexican-Comanche relations had soured. Raiding parties of Indian men began attacking isolated haciendas, towns, sometimes even cities.
The violence intensified throughout the 1830s and 1840s, devastating the region. UC Berkeley historian Brian DeLay has studied this crisis. When I sat down with him recently, I asked, where did the beleaguered Mexicans turn for help?
Well, that was the million-dollar question. And so across northern Mexico, whether you're a rancher or you're the sort of the head of a hacienda or you're a local official or you're a state authority, you're desperately looking for some superior who's going to provide you with weapons, with money, with men, some kind of an army force that's going to be able to march into Indian territory and convince them not to launch these raids. And Mexico in the 1830s and 1840s was just entering a profound political crisis and found itself completely incapable of dealing with this widespread complex problem in any kind of substantial way. And so throughout the 1830s and 1840s, as the violence across the North spreads and becomes more severe and more economically and politically consequential, people are constantly sending letters to the central government saying, you got to help us. You got to find a way to deal with this. This is a national problem.
Right.
And they felt sympathetic to a certain extent, but they basically replied and said, look, this is effectively a crime wave. And once we have our house in order, we'll try to help you with it. But right now, there's nothing that we can do to address this problem.
Now, we all know that world history pivots around the chronology of American history, and so I can't help but notice that you talk about the 1830s and 1840s as if this is all happening without the United States making everything happen. So I'm a little puzzled. You've already described a really complicated situation, but complicated even more by inserting the United States into this.
By the middle of the 1840s, both sides, both Mexicans looking towards the United States and the United States looking towards Mexico, had come to use the Indians in between them as kind of lenses that they could look through and look at each other through. Hmm. And they were quite useful that way because they revealed precisely what they wanted to see. So for Mexico, by the middle of the 1840s, Mexicans at very high levels came to believe that these Indian raids, which were growing worse and worse every year and really had begun to peak in 1845, couldn't be the consequence of Indian decisions. Indians were simply too disorganized, too primitive to do such damage to a modern nation state. So there must be some more significant force behind them. And understandably, they came to believe that it was the Texans and most especially the United States that was actively manipulating these people into launching these devastating raids in advance of a planned invasion. That wasn't true, but that's what the Mexicans came to believe and to say to each other. And then on the side of the Americans, what they're seeing is this appalling, terrible disaster unfolding. And it's fascinating to them, partly because it seems to be the exact sort of mirror image of what has been happening in the United States, right? I mean, after all, they had just pretty much concluded this major campaign to force all the native people east of the Mississippi, west of the Mississippi.
Right.
And the reverse is happening in Mexico.
They're sort of letting civilization down, right? I mean, they're not doing their part.
They are blowing it for the civilization team, exactly. So that really, I think, in a very powerful way shapes what Americans think about Mexico. And ultimately, it shapes the way they think about Mexico's rights to this vast territory.
So tell me about the actual waging of the war and the presence of the Comanche in that war.
So when the United States invaded Mexico, it was already a moment when Indian violence, not only with Comanches, but Apaches and Navajos as well, had become worse and more widespread than it had been in a generation. And that only accelerates during the war itself. And so Mexicans are literally fighting two wars at one time.
Wow.
And the American forces and the American commanders knew this very well. They had been paying close attention to this 10 years of sort of looking at northern Mexico and marveling at the crisis that's happening there. And so they shrewdly planned to use this to their advantage. So President Polk and his generals talk deeply about this, and they go down to northern Mexico with instructions, the things that they're going to say to Mexicans that they find there. And so American commanders are going into northern Mexico and telling them, we know that your government has completely abandoned you over the last decade, and we're going to change that, and we're going to help protect you against Indians, and we're going to save your wives and your children who are being held captive by these Indians, so long as you don't turn against us. So they're using it rhetorically, but they're also, of course, relying on this very practical level, hoping, correctly as it turned out, that the huge majority of northern Mexicans would feel not in a position to wage an insurgent war against the occupying force or swell the Mexican army in an effect to drive back the American advance.
So as you know, the United States wins this big victory. They have the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, in which they get all this territory from Mexico. Well, how do we make sense of this?
So the war ends in this astonishing way that we don't really think about it as astonishing anymore. We've naturalized it in this country. But the fact that Mexico was compelled to surrender half of its national territory is just an amazing outcome to this war. And the fact that a Republican government, the first big Republican government and the one that many other states in the hemisphere look to as a model, is going to attack a weaker country, invade it, and compel it to surrender half its national territory, I think requires more explanation than we usually give it. And it seems to me that the key factor there was this widespread sense that there really was no injury to northern Mexico in taking this territory. In fact, it would be a benefit to northern Mexico because the Americans would stop the Indians from attacking and stealing women and children and killing people below the river. And Polk makes a speech to Congress wherein he makes plain this idea that, you know, this really isn't even doing Mexico any damage. On the contrary, we're going to be doing Mexico a favor. So here's what he says. He says, "It would be a blessing to all these northern states to have their citizens protected against the Indians by the power of the United States. At this moment, many Mexicans, principally females and children, are in captivity among them. If New Mexico were held and governed by the United States, we could effectually prevent these tribes from committing such outrages and compel them to release these captives and restore them to their families and friends." And I think, you know, that kind of captures the argument.
Can you tell us about the treaty?
The treaty that ended the war had a clause that was all about this. It was Article 11 of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo that bound the United States to prevent Indians living north of the new border from raiding south into Mexico. And it also bound the Americans to redeem any captives that they come to know are being held by Indians living north of the border. But that's not what happens. Immediately following the war, raids only increase, and they steadily increase during the late 1840s and early 1850s. And American government, American army found it to be completely impossible to police this massive, massive expanse and to stop Indians from raiding into Mexico. And when the violence only gets worse and these large landholders especially suffer major losses in terms of animals that were destroyed or killed and people that had been killed and kidnapped, they begin talking about remedies. And happily, lawyers from New York City arrive and begin organizing these aggrieved property holders and telling them that the United States is bound by international treaty to prevent these things that are happening nonetheless, that they are entitled to compensation. And so in the face of threatened lawsuits, immense lawsuits for tens of millions of dollars for Mexican landowners in the South, the American government leans on Mexico to free them from the obligations of Article 11 in a treaty that it concluded with Mexico in 1853 and 54 called the Gadsden Purchase, which acquired a strip of land in what's now southern Arizona and New Mexico for the United States and relieved the United States of any obligation under Article 11.
You know, it's interesting the way American history is usually taught. Mexico just seems kind of just sitting there waiting for us to go into a war with it. The Indians are usually saved for the New West part after the fall break, after Christmas break and Reconstruction, right? And so
that's right.
And so, Brian, it sounds to me as if you're saying that it's actually relationships among Mexicans and Indians and Anglo settlers is actually more germane in the actual beginning of the war. Would that be a fair statement?
I definitely think that I completely agree with what you said about our perceptions and the way we narrate this event. And I think the great symptom of that way of thinking, you know, the way of thinking that says Mexico really doesn't matter, it's just waiting, and the Indians, we can wait until after fall break to get to those guys.
Right.
I think the great symptom of that is Manifest Destiny, that we have spent so much intellectual energy, and we spend enough time with our students talking about this thing called Manifest Destiny, because we fundamentally believe that what Americans thought about themselves was a lot more important than what was actually happening in these places and who lived there and what they were up to. But the place itself, Indians and relationships between Indians and Mexicans and the fundamental weakness of the Mexican government, that was far more important to determining why the war started and why it ended the way that it did.
Brian DeLay is a historian at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of War of a Thousand Deserts, Indian Raids, and the U.S.-Mexican War. So guys, help me map this really interesting story about the Comanches and the Mexicans onto the big story that we kind of have an idea about Mexican-American relations. How does this all fit together?
Well, Ed, I like the use of the word map because we are talking about a map in which we don't have a clearly defined border. We have a vast region in which there is no effective state authority. And it really was Indian country, and they set the terms of play. So it's a vacuum of effective authority that creates the conditions for warfare, for violent conflict.
So, Peter, I concede that, but I'm going to make at least a small case for the state. Perhaps the jurisdiction is not there, but both states play a crucial role on one issue, and that is the issue of slavery.
Yeah.
It seems that we're ignoring the fact that Mexico outlaws slavery and that there are many among southern states within the United States who want to extend slavery into this Mexican territory. Am I wrong about that, Ed?
Now, you're exactly right, Brian, and that's one reason the Mexican War is so volatile in the United States, because Southerners are saying, yeah, let's go to war with Mexico, and people in the North are saying, what? We don't need Mexico,
yeah.
And if we do, it's just going to engorge slavery. So it becomes really one of the things that disrupts the politics of the nation state that does exist.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the Civil War that grows as a result of that destabilization, Peter, ironically, the great difference between Mexico and the United States is resolved. Once the United States abolishes slavery, then that sharp boundary between the two on that issue is resolved.
And Ed, let's think about how invisible the boundaries between the South and the North within the United States become after the issue of slavery is resolved. Well, that same concept can be applied to the international boundary.
Good point.
That boundary is crucial. It settles the slavery issue between the United States and Mexico. But ironically, because that big issue is settled, the border kind of recedes. We have a regular, steady flow of both Mexicans and Americans back and forth between Mexico for more than 100 years. It's punctuated on occasion by scares, by crackdowns on Mexican immigrants, by a reaction to 9/11. But the default position is a virtually invisible border with a very natural flow of commerce back and forth, except for those exceptional moments. It's time for a short break. When we get back, why some 19th century Americans compared President Ulysses Grant
to a Mexican dictator.
You're listening to Backstory. We'll be back in a minute.
This is Backstory. I'm Brian Bello.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Peter Onuf. Today on the show, we take on the history of Mexican-U.S. relations. And we've reached the point in the show where we turn to listeners who have reached out to us about this week's topic. We've got Beth on the line from Salt Lake City. Hey, Beth, welcome to Backstory.
Hi, thank you.
Hey, great to have you. So what's up today? You got something to ask us about Mexican-American relations.
Yes, I was wondering about the instances where, like, the border between the United States and Mexico kind of goes through the middle of the community, right. Specifically Nogales, Arizona, or places like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, how did that happen, number one, and how does that shape the communities that and the people that live there?
Well, it can make life very difficult, for starters. One thing that leads to divisions, of course, is that where people cross the border, there's a lot of business that attends that. So populations grow on border towns. But sometimes borders do cut through existing communities, and they did that along the Mexican border.
I think the larger framework, though, here, Beth, is that it's actually quite natural. And you put your finger on this. It's quite natural for there to be a flow back and forth between these two countries. In fact, it's the very conception of the border that is really quite an artificial thing. And historically speaking, it's been wide open. And that's the natural thing for people to move back and forth. And what drives them back and forth? Well, family ties, trade we've talked about, but the economic fates of both nations is a real driver for people back and forth. And they've, for much of American and Mexican history, they've been allowed to do that quite freely.
Though I think it's also true, Brian, that customs does establish offices along the border, the Canadian border, the Mexican border. The state makes an appearance, and the state does so because it needs to control the flow of goods and population. And so it doesn't do so efficiently, and there's no reason to do it until the modern period when these issues about maintaining the wall against the flood of immigration. What I think is remarkable about American demographic history, American population, is that we celebrate the kind of tide of settlement that moves across the Anglo frontiers as if it were natural. But when people try to cross into America, all of a sudden that's a terrible thing because it's the wrong people who are spreading across the land.
You know, one thing that you can guarantee are going to be different on different sides of a border are laws. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just by the nature of a different entity with a different history. And a crucial element on this was that Mexico stood for freedom. And so you see these fascinating accounts of African-American slaves trying to make it into Mexico because they could find refuge there. So it's the exact opposite. Now, this is the very beginning. This is 18-teens, 20s, and 30s.
Right.
And because Mexico is anti-slavery before the United States is.
That's so interesting. I've never thought about slavery in that context before. Maybe it's because I'm kind of from the Southwest, and right. That's just not something that we think about as much. So that's an interesting point. I've never thought about that
before.
And
it says that borders matter. States matter because legal institutions are going to determine how people live and what they can do and whether they're free to move. And, of course, a slave has a boundary right around him or her, can't move anywhere legally.
Right.
It's interesting, isn't it, Beth, though, that is not really the story that Americans
right.
tell about themselves, is that it expanding American reach actually was expanding the reach of slavery that Mexico, which we see as a struggling state, was trying to create this liberal change. So it kind of turns history wrong side out from the American perspective. So I tell you, I don't think there's many borders around this question, Beth. I think
you're boundless.
Indeed.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot, Beth.
Thank you,
Beth.
All right.
Today, we have not one, but two calls from Utah. It's Susan on the line from Salt Lake City. Hey, Susan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We're talking about Mexican-American relations. You got a question for us?
Yes, I do. My question is, when is the U.S. going to start educating students regarding the real history between the U.S. and Mexico, starting with the fact that a good portion of the U.S. was part of Mexico?
Right. And when is that going to get through to American school children and therefore to American public opinion? Susan wants to know, and we're on unfamiliar ground when we talk about the future, but we know the past. Where's it going, guys?
Well, I think what the past shows is that when any population becomes powerful, it can actually shape the way that its history is told. Mm-hmm. And so we can think about the sudden so-called discovery of African-American history after the Civil Rights Movement, and then think about the discovery of women's history after the feminist movement. I think that one of the first things that underrepresented populations do is make sure that they are actually represented in the history of the nation. So I will make the bold prediction that in the next 10 to 15 years, there will be a major recasting American history.
We're going to do better, but it's pretty hard not to do better, isn't it? Susan, what's your sense of where we are right now?
Well, I live in Utah, and I grew up in Utah. And as we know, as you and I know, Utah was part of Mexico, all
yep.
of it. Mm-hmm. And when I grew up, we did not learn that. We learned that Utah history began on the 24th of July in 1847 when the Mormon pioneers came to Utah. And if there was anything that happened before then, it certainly was nothing of value.
Right.
And the people who were here before that were not of value either.
Yeah. Well, I think you've identified what the great master narrative of American history has been. And it's an east-west movement. It's not just Mormons. It's the whole country. It's manifest destiny, as John L. O'Sullivan coined it in the Democratic Review in the 1840s. It's what America had to be to fulfill itself was to move westward. But isn't there a big change, however, in the way people in Utah are thinking about the world?
Yeah, things are changing. My daughter's half Mexican. And I made sure she grew up speaking Spanish because I didn't want her to feel a sense of not belonging here in Utah and a sense of not belonging in Mexico. So I've really had to work hard to keep her connected with Mexican culture and speaking Spanish, and it's worked. But there's so many kids that are in that situation. Salt Lake City elementary schools are now 55% so-called minority, 42% Hispanic. Of that, 75% is of Mexican heritage. So it has to change, and it is changing. And that's why I started a nonprofit to use art as a way to help kids connect with their Latino heritage and to show the overall community the beauty of Latino heritage.
And Susan, the kind of history that I think you're encouraging with your nonprofit and with your efforts is telling personal stories. But there's also the big idea about what America is. And I think a key word in understanding how we can rethink it is frontier. What is a frontier? Is it a place where European settlers discover their genius for democracy? That's the so-called Turner thesis, Frederick Jackson Turner, going back to 1893, which is the great narrative of American history. Or is a frontier a contested line between two empires or nation states? Or is frontier actually a much more extensive borderland that includes a wide array of people sorting their lives out in a shared space? And when you think of a frontier as a place where really interesting and important things happen because of the interactions of different peoples and cultures, then you're going to have a reason to take other people's stories seriously because they're part of your story.
And part of that is understanding that the frontier is not just a piece of time, but it's a perpetually recreated situation, right? So, Susan, I think what you're talking about is living on a new kind of cultural frontier, and you're a kind of a pioneer who is sort of forging a new language that people can talk to each other. So,
and thanks for provoking this discussion.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you for listening.
Throughout most of this show, we focused on how the U.S. and Mexico have defined themselves against each other. But our final story today is about a time when Americans saw the U.S. as very similar to Mexico in some alarming ways.
In the 1860s, both the United States and Mexico faced serious political crises. In the U.S., Southern secession had sparked a civil war. In Mexico, a European invasion led to the installation of a French-backed emperor.
By 1867, the Mexican Liberal Party had managed to reinstate Republican government, but their control was shaky. In some parts of the country, warlords had much more authority than the government did.
Meanwhile, Republican politicians in the U.S. were struggling to control the defeated South. These Republicans noticed Mexico's warlord problem and thought it looked disturbingly familiar.
And so they make very direct analogies to say that our Ku Klux Klan leaders are exactly the same as these Mexican warlords who are plaguing the liberal government there.
This is Greg Downs, a historian at the City University of New York. He says that the Republicans who were worried about post-war instability in the U.S. started using a new word, Mexicanization. They said that white Southern resistance to federal control was, quote, Mexicanizing the U.S.
Democrats, meanwhile, looked to Mexico and drew a different conclusion. They pointed out the threat of dictatorship, too much federal power, not too little. And all their worst fears were confirmed when Republican Ulysses S. Grant, former commander of the U.S. Army, was elected president in 1868.
And quickly, Grant emerges in Democratic discourse as a United States Santa Ana, referring to this Mexican leader who had been multiple times president and general, who's sort of lurking in the shadows throughout much of these 1860s crises, you know, available and eager to come back to march back as a dictator. And so it's a military takeover of the civil government.
And so, the Democrats have the actual Reconstruction legislation, pretty assertive control by the central government in the United States. That's what they have in mind.
That's correct.
And also the actual military occupation of the South during Reconstruction.
That's correct. Absolutely.
So you have these two very conflicting uses of Mexicanization.
And they bespeak how tumultuous the post-Civil War period was in the United States. Both ideas had a certain resonance. To us, we'd take for granted that the United States wasn't going to enter into a series of escalating civil wars. But it's exactly this fear that both Republicans and Democrats are speaking about. And they're using Mexico to raise the possibility that a republic could disintegrate into a multitude of civil wars. So they have a common condition, and they're creating exactly opposite diagnoses.
So Mexicanization becomes the language that the Republican and Democratic parties use to battle out one of their central differences, that's national power versus states' rights.
That's right. And if you want to hear something that truly shows you how strange, that reminds you how strange language works, in the midst of this, something else hits American newspapers, which is that in Mexico— Right? You know, the thing about referring to Mexico all the time in their language is that Mexico is itself a place with its own history and its own present change. And in the midst of this, in December 1876, Porfirio Diaz, who will become the central figure of the next 50 years or almost 50, 40 years of Mexican history, overthrows his rival Lerdo de Tejada and asserts his control over the Mexican government. And amazingly, the way that American newspapers refer to this is Mexico has been Mexicanized. In retrospect, it's clear that the American newspapers exactly misunderstood Diaz, because what actually emerges out of Diaz's rule of Mexico is the opposite, and what we would look back now and say an excess of stabilization, that Diaz moves toward a single-party state. He not only eliminates ongoing civil wars and peripheral fights against the center, but he eliminates a great deal of politics itself.
But wouldn't that correspond to one of the two meanings of Mexicanization?
That's exactly right. Yeah, that they haven't connected. They imagine that Diaz is overthrowing Lerdo de Tejada, and there'll be another one coming.
So the newspapers are responding. They're using Mexicanization in the Republican way.
That's right.
That it's a never-ending series of one revolution after another. But in fact, as I recall, Diaz remains president for something like 35 or 40 years. In fact, the history of it was the way the Democrats were using Mexicanization, meaning there's going to be this rule from the center and it's going to stifle local initiative.
That's right. So during the 70s, any time when there's a disputed election in Maine, I mean, in Maine of all places, where they say, you know, look how far we've come, even New Englanders are being Mexicanized. It's not just the South. When there's discussion of the overthrow of the last Reconstruction governments, Mexicanization has kind of become the default go-to word to say why your opponents are behaving illegitimately. And that ends in the early 1880s, especially in the aftermath of the assassination of Garfield, because immediately once he's assassinated, Mexicanization is used to describe it all the time, right? Assassination is the way that Mexicanization happens. Over time, as Garfield takes a long time to die and as the presumption becomes that he was killed not by, you know, a conspiracy but by a lone individual, he becomes this rallying point of a cross-partisan rallying point. And Mexicanization fades over the in its usage over the 1880s and 1890s until it
and
becomes
a kind
of—
And as the settlement begins to take hold, the South kind of begins to implement Jim Crow and really does assert states' rights, yet— You know, the nation remains whole. There are not civil wars.
That's right. There's one of the ironies of this is that at the moment they give up on comparing the United States to Mexico, the countries are actually taking quite similar paths. There's a difference in degree. But if we look at it from, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, what you see is that both countries emerge out of periods of civil wars with a fear that the problem that caused the civil war was essentially democracy. And so the growth of an anti-democratic pushback as a way of stabilizing, of stopping civil wars. For the Porfiriato, that became through the creation of a one-party state and then eventually of a basically permanent president. The United States retains the two-party state on a national level, but moves toward a one-party state in the South. And quickly over the 80s and then especially over the 90s and early 1900s, toward the restriction of who can participate in politics. So on the largest level, the participation of African-American men in the South is dramatically restricted in disfranchisement.
So just to pause there, you're talking about the rise of Jim Crow legislation in the South.
That's right.
And in the North?
You can see the restrictions that are put on immigrant voting. So that one of the leading scholars of national voting calls it a national disfranchisement campaign. And that the overall voting in presidential elections drops by about a third over the early 1900s. And so we face this irony, which is that the United States and Mexico in some ways are continuing to follow similar democratic paths. And yet at exactly that same moment, the United States is losing its sense that it's like Mexico, that because of the persistence of the two-party system, the United States starts to see Mexico as a military dictatorship and the United States as this flourishing democracy, even as democracy is dying.
Greg Downs is a historian at the City College of New York and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. We'll link to his article, The Mexicanization of American Politics, on our website, backstoryradio.org. Let me take you out west, the mid-1800s. Mexico owned a lot of the West and we wanted it. So saddle up, I'ma sing you a sonnet on the Mexican-American War and how we won it. That's going to do it for us today. But we've got plenty of extras online, including the story of how Mexican fears about marijuana helped to transform U.S. drug policy in the 1930s. You can hear that story at backstoryradio.org.
As always, you can find a lot of other Backstory goodies on our Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr pages. Our handle is Backstory Radio. Don't be a stranger.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Jess Ingebretson, Nina Ernest, Andrew Parsons, and Jesse Dukes. Emily Charnock is our research and web coordinator, and Jamal Milner is our engineer. Our intern is Abe Schenck. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major support for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation. Additional support is provided by Weinstein Properties and History Channel. History made every day. The rest is history that we still live. If you live out west, then you gotta feel this. Texas, Cali, Utah, Colorado, Arizona, Nevada, were states that we fought for.
Brian Ballow is professor of history at the University of Virginia. Peter Onuf is professor of history emeritus at UVA and senior research fellow at Monticello. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.